Today, we look beyond the immediate crisis and ask, how should we build a new economy in the post-virus world?
The coronavirus is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades.
We're at war. In a true sense, we're at war.
There's an ancient Chinese expression that says, may you live in interesting times.
Welcome to Coronavirus Lockdown with me, Zoe Williams, and my co-host, Luke Cooper. The world economy has grown to a halt. Massive state interventions have put the system on life support. Millions face the dole. And our core workers struggle on through the crisis, often with poor conditions and poverty pay. So today we ask, is this one giant wake-up call to change the system for good? How do we build a new economy fit for the 21st century?
Around the world, economies are crumbling.
With 22 million filing for jobless benefits in just the last 3 weeks, wiping out a decade of job gains.
The government's economic forecaster today spelling out an apocalyptic scenario. 2 million unemployed and the economy shrinking more than in the financial crisis.
In the digital, not real world studio today, we're joined by economist, author of The Green New Deal and close friend of Another Europe is Possible campaign, Anne Pettifer. We're also pleased to welcome back regular on the show, Nick Gearden of Global Justice Now. To feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future, email podcast@anothereurope.org. You can support the podcast by leaving a rating or review on your podcast platform. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe. To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join. It's cheap as chips and it makes a big difference.
Anne, welcome to the show. So look, you've been a critic of neoliberalism or free market economic thinking for a long, long time. You see this as leading to the 2008 financial crisis and also encouraging a greed is good ethos in society. So can you tell us about that?
I wrote a book predicting the great financial crisis just simply because I'd worked on price inflicted on low-income countries in the 1980s and 90s as a result of a massive debt inflation caused by financial deregulation and the ability of creditors to, if you like, create new credit effortlessly and to burden the world with it. And it was clear to me that that was going to blow up and collapse. And sure enough, it did. And then we had this great crisis and very little happened. And one of my bugbears is that the reason that very little happened to change the system was that actually none of us, especially on the left, had a really real understanding of what it was about. And, you know, we weren't alone. The central bank governors didn't understand what had happened. Many economists didn't know what had happened. You know, they were all stunned. But the progressive end of the political spectrum really hadn't made the effort to understand the way in which the international system worked and therefore didn't understand when it collapsed. And as a result, the system consolidated itself after 2007-9 and just got bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, and inflated more and more debt. The imbalances of the system led to massive inequality, but also the corrections to the imbalances of 2007-9 led to the repression of incomes, basically, and the poor and the rest of us, actually, almost everybody, had their incomes cut back.
Handling three jobs or two jobs at a time for years, it just takes a lot of time out of you, and it's tough. It's tough. A lot of time goes by on just paying bills.
As the mainstream economists tried to fix the system, it, of course, that just made it worse. And we're back where we were, actually. We have a massive debt overload, and now we've confronted by a pandemic, and managing that is causing the system effectively to collapse. Global capitalism is collapsing around us as we speak. And I don't think that people on the left fully grasp the scale of that collapse.
You quote a line in your Green New Deal book that power can seize nothing without a demand. And it really rang true because that's sort of the story of the financial crash, is that they crashed themselves, but because we had no demands, they conceded nothing and they just consolidated power afterwards.
Absolutely, Zoe. I remember very vividly, you know, the period between 2007-9, the bankers were really terrified. And they expected to go to jail. they expected some punitive treatment for what they had done. And to their utter amazement, rather than being punished, they were bailed out. Rather than being punished, they were rewarded.
Barclays has been accused of burying bad news on Budget Day as 9 top bankers were handed the best part of £40 million.
Rather than being punished, post-crisis, governments backed their speculation and their greed. Pre-crisis, they'd had to bear the risks themselves of their speculation. Post-crisis, all the big banks were too big to fail, too big to go to jail, and were all guaranteed by central banks and by governments. So they couldn't believe their luck post-crisis. And now this virus, this tiny invisible virus, has blown up the whole thing. And it's falling around us. I think what's happening today with the collapse of the oil market and the oil price is incredibly significant, because the oil price is closely linked to dollarization of the global economy. The Americans did a deal with the Saudis that if the Saudis agreed to finance their deficit, then they would give the Saudis military kit and protect them and so on. And the terms were, we'll look after you if you'll deposit all your profits from the sale of oil in the Federal Reserve and buy US treasuries and keep us afloat, basically. That is going to collapse as the price of oil collapses. And it's incredibly important, especially if you look at it from the perspective of poor countries who are forced to buy almost everything that they need in dollars. And dollars right now have risen in value, and therefore increase their debts and increase the cost of their imports. If they have to buy soya beans or copper or oil, because the dollar has risen, even while the oil price may have fallen, the cost of those imports is higher. Plus, the strengthening of the dollar has crashed their currencies. So that increases generally their import costs and their borrowing costs and their debt service costs. And at the same time as all that happening to those countries, they're having to deal with a plague, essentially. So I feel we're at a moment where the system is really quite close to collapse. And the question is, what comes next? And what does the left have to say about that?
The mainstream economic thinking is a little bit schizophrenic on this question, I think. On the one hand, private sector debt, always good. Or at least not that bad, or at least it's something that's really necessary for the economy to float around and for capitalists to make a lot of money. And public sector debt, always bad, always needs to be driven down. What role does debt play? And I wonder if you could draw that out for us.
I'm a great fan of credit and of a system of credit. I believe that if you're fortunate enough to live in a country with a developed monetary system that is able to dispense credit, you're extraordinarily lucky. If you live in a poor country in Africa, which doesn't have a developed monetary system and all of the public infrastructure that upholds that system, there is literally no money, right? So I'm watching South Africa. You know, I'm South African born, but right now there's a furious debate in South Africa and also in Rwanda as to why South Africa and Rwanda have to borrow money from abroad to deal with their crisis. Rich countries in the north, the United States and Britain, are able to mobilize finance to deal with their crisis in the way that we have done, whereas countries like South Africa and Rwanda have to borrow dollars from abroad to finance their management of the crisis. And they're beginning to ask the question of why can't they print money for their economies in the way the Americans print money for their economy. And the reason is that the system is so constructed as to prevent them from doing that. The IMF will not encourage a poor country to set up a developed monetary system because that takes public resources and it has to be a public institution. It has to have a central bank, which is a public institution. It has to have a tax collection system, which employs tax collectors by the government and is managed publicly. It has to have an accounting system which is regulated by the public sector. And the IMF and the World Bank will not allow countries to invest in that. Instead, they say, oh, no, don't worry about investing in public institutions. You can always borrow dollars from the United States of America or Japanese yen or British sterling. Don't worry, we'll dole out this money to you. And all you have to do is to flog us all your valuable assets and repay us, you know. And I think what's happening now is that these countries are realizing finally that they've been badly shortchanged, that they too should have the public institutions, the public infrastructure, which allows them to create money and which allows their governments to deal with domestic crises. So that's fascinating. It's very slow. It's been very late coming. But it shows the injustice of a system which has been constructed to allow the great empires to dispense credit, if you like, at great cost to the colonies, if you like, and extract assets in return.
It is interesting to thrash out what the major icebergs looming are in terms of capitalism and the world economy. So if we take oil, as you've described, debt, as you've described, kind of the awakening of these debt-bound countries, as you describe, surely it makes a difference that America is becoming a kind of failed state.
It's really bizarre what is happening, because on the one hand, the government of the United States is clowning around, literally clowning around, and withdrawing from its leadership role in the world. And so last week, for example, they vetoed the right of the IMF to issue SDRs, which is a form of money for poor countries in very large sums, which would have helped these poor countries in dealing with the crisis. Trump personally vetoed this, right? On the other hand, the Federal Reserve is effectively running the world at the moment. So the Federal Reserve is dispensing cash to every credit market there is in the world, on the one hand. And on the other hand, it's dispensing dollars to central banks around the world. Now, that's because everyone's having to dish out dollars to buy oil or soybeans or copper, and there ain't enough dollars in the world. So the Fed is having to feed dollars into the global economy to enable people to buy stuff, essentially. Because you're not allowed to buy stuff with a South African rand or a Nigerian naira. Nobody wants those currencies, right? You've got to have dollars, or you've got to have some other hard currency. So the Fed is feeding dollars into the central banks of the OECD countries and one or two others, but not into the poor countries. South Africa doesn't get dollars. It doesn't feed it into countries that it doesn't consider to be, I don't know, stable enough or whatever. And it doesn't provide dollars to China. Now, China also needs dollars, and China is beginning to recover and wanting to buy stuff and is having to buy stuff. You know, you can't buy oil with any other currency except dollars. Now, if China runs out of dollars, it's going to have to either cash in its US treasuries, the American debt, which the Chinese have been financing by buying up those debts, and they're going to have to convert that debt into dollars in order to buy oil, for example. Or they're going to have to find some other way of raising dollars. But you can see how this power of the Fed to provide dollars to dispense largesse to its friends and to ignore those and to ignore the others is going to raise massive tensions. But it's also as if the Fed actually is the government of the world, regardless of what Trump gets up to. Nobody cares, because the Fed is running the global economy at the moment. Someone wrote a piece in Dissent last week saying that the United States is not so much a country with a central bank, it's actually a central bank with a country attached to it. And that's what's happening. And that is weird, really. But it is also the basis of global tension and the rising global tensions.
So, Nick, let's bring you in here, because you're obviously doing a lot of work at the moment on these issues about the huge global disparities that this crisis is exposing between the global north and the global south. And in the global north, we're so het up naturally with our own crisis. Our eyes are almost completely closed off to the potential of this.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's not just the health crisis. So we've heard about some of the figures of just how completely screwed some countries' health systems are, you know, where there's countries that, you know, have kind of three ventilators for the whole country. In fact, there was another very interesting statistic I read the other day that for low-income countries, that the amount that they spend per head on healthcare a year, public healthcare, is about $40 per person. In the West, the average is about $2,500. So it's about 70 times different. So there's a massive health crisis, and that health health crisis has been created by the financial system that Anne was talking about, this very financialized neoliberalism. Anne used to work on a debt crisis that began in the late 1970s and through the 1980s and into the 1990s, which at the time we called the third world debt crisis, whereby essentially banks had made these enormous risky loans to developing world countries, stacked up this debt. When the debt crisis was eventually triggered because interest rates were pushed up in the United States, the banks were bailed out essentially by public institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. And those institutions came in and started dictating economic policies to dozens of countries around the world. And what did they tell those countries to do? Permanent austerity. I mean, no public spending, privatize everything in sight because that will raise you some dollars and you can use that to pay back the debt, and give up any kind of control over money coming in and out of your economy, give up any control over your trading system, you know, just pure neoliberalism. And that's part of the reason why so many countries around the world were unable to develop welfare states, were unable to spend money on healthcare and so on. So these things are very interconnected. But now what you also see is the economic crisis. It's not just a health crisis, it's an economic crisis that follows in its wake. And for many developing countries, and in some ways, middle income countries are just as badly off here, if not worse than low income countries. This has seen a complete capital flight. So you've got something like $100 billion has left developing economies within, you know, a few weeks. I think the FT said it was something like four times the capital flight from developing economies that we saw in 2008 in a comparable level of time. So absolutely enormous. And these economies are so poor or bereft of the kind of tools that Western governments are using, the US and European governments are using, that there's not much they can do about it because they've been told for decades now, you shouldn't make any attempt to try to control these capital flights. You should make no attempt to control the international money market. They are the invisible hand of the market will ensure everything's okay if you just leave everything to market mechanisms. And they're seeing their economies completely destroyed now. And so, you know, not only are many countries in a position where they would already have struggled at the best of times to contain a pandemic like this, but the economic policy tools that they need to do it have been taken away from them, and capital is flowing out of their economies. Commodities that many of them are dependent on have gone through the floor. The UN body UNCTAD is saying that they risk an $800 billion shortfall from export markets this year. So, you know, an absolute crisis, but a crisis, not a kind of natural crisis. You know, it's not just that they're poor, so they can't deal with this. It's that actually the very institutions that are supposed to govern and stabilize the economic system have been so, neoliberalism and financialization have been so embedded in these institutions that they've forced kind of policy conditionality onto these countries to force them to give up any policy tools that are now being used by Western governments like our own.
It just occurred to me while you were both speaking, I don't know why I hadn't thought of this before, but it seems obvious but important that in 2008 it was a banking crisis. If you asked someone going to the supermarket what was happening, they would say, God, have you seen Northern Rock? Or, you know, it looks really bad, I'm worried about my savings, etc. Whereas this time, all of the mechanisms that you're both describing are hidden. So a lot of the mechanisms that are bailing out and supporting the financial system, most people would have no clue that this is happening. So the support is closed off, and that's, it seems to me, that could have quite a negative impact on the politics because it's the financial system that needs such reform.
Absolutely, Luke, and that's why what you're doing is so important. It really is important for us to be raising these issues. This is going to accelerate global tensions. And we know that this is what happened in the 1930s. You know, we had massive debt inflations then and massive debt deflations. Well, 1929 was a massive debt deflation. We've had a massive debt inflation leading up to 2007-9. And then instead of kind of killing it off and slowly deflating it, we allowed it to expand even further. When the central banks of the world, including the Fed, allowed it to inflate even further. And now the Federal Reserve is doling out even more loans to kind of keep the show on the road, to keep the debt buoyant, if you like. And in a sense, this comes back to your question about what is good credit and what is good and bad debt. And it's true that private debt is always seen as being healthy and public as dangerous. Right now, we can see the value of the public sector, getting into debt, if you like, to bail out the system. But the problem isn't credit or debt itself. The problem is the scale of it, because it always has to, in the end, correlate with the real economy. It always, in the end, has to correlate with real assets. You know, you cannot build up massive liabilities if you're not equally building up assets. You can't build up massive amounts of debt if you're not simultaneously generating some income for repaying that debt. Because if you do that, then you're going to have debt defaults, you're going to have collapse of debt, you know. And then the problem with that is that leads to economic failure, which leads to political unrest, which leads to political tensions, rising authoritarianism. And in the 1930s, it ended up leading to war. Now, you know, we're not quite there yet, but we are in the territory of global political tensions, which are invisible on the whole to us because we're so preoccupied with this pandemic. And let's face it, it's damn scary. I'm terrified of it. And it is very preoccupying. But you're right, it serves as a screen to hide what is happening behind. And of course, the powers that be would rather we didn't pay attention to those matters. We didn't pay attention to what the Federal Reserve is doing, what the Bank of England is doing, and what the impact is on the rest of the world and how that's going to rebound in the very near future.
I was really struck all the way through the Chancellor's announcements by, again, a line from your book, Anne, which is, we can afford what we do. And suddenly the Conservatives have discovered this untold money that they can spend on social good, which previously was impossible and unfindable. And it makes me think that maybe some positives will come out. The first and most obvious of which is environmental. If we make this reckoning with ourselves about which bits of our lives were necessary and which bits were not necessary, then maybe governments can make those reckonings as well. Do you see that happening?
Indeed. I'm just very struck by, I go cycling every morning and the roads are empty, the birds are incredibly noisy, and the air is clean. And I think that the world around is seeing all this, you know, people are seeing this. The other thing that's happening is the eruption of community support and solidarity. It's deeply embedded in us, you know. No matter how hard the capitalist system tried to drum individualism into us, it really hasn't succeeded, as we can see. I mean, there's extraordinary in my little community amount of solidarity and community involvement. So that's all happening. But also what is happening, as you say, Zoe, is that there's been a massive U-turn on the part of the orthodoxy, the economic orthodoxy, the treasury, the conservatives, and they've suddenly found the money, and it's clear that there is money, and it's clear that the government has the power to finance the treatment of this pandemic, and it should. It has a massive obligation to save the lives of its people and to defend their security. Now, I think there's already plans afoot for ensuring that this is followed by austerity. I can see already voices being raised on the right. I mean, the Resolution Foundation is beginning to talk about the problem of debt, and certainly the OBR is going to warn us that we can't afford to do this. So I think the preparation for reacting against this is already in train. And we really have to fight that. We really have to say that it is possible to finance a transformation of the economy away from its addiction to fossil fuels, and we have to do it urgently. And the thing that gives me hope is the fact that the airlines are going to collapse. I think it's going to be very hard and very tricky for people to fly in the future. People are going to be really cautious about getting on airplanes that are effectively vectors for disease, right? They contain you within a box, sealed into a box where, you know, viruses can easily transmit. But furthermore, they move viruses from one continent to another. So this is going to transform our view of the airline industry, in my view, and certainly many airlines will go bust. And the question then will become whether or not the government has the courage and the wise macroeconomic sense to nationalize the institutions and the markets that are failing right now. I think we ought to be nationalizing the oil sector, for example. We should be nationalizing coal and we should be nationalizing airlines. And there are two reasons for that. One, because if they are nationalized, then the state can ensure that they are used for the purposes of addressing of climate breakdown, number one. Secondly, they place assets onto the balance sheets of the state. And assets are really necessary when the state is building up liabilities. I'm not one of those people that believes the state should build up infinite liabilities, and it really doesn't matter how much it has in liabilities. I don't agree with that. I think there must be a time when we restore some balance to the public finances. In the meantime, let's acquire these assets and put them on the balance sheet. They become an asset against the liability, and in the future, they may generate income. If we nationalize the railways, which is what we have not yet done, we've nationalized their losses for the next 6 months, but we haven't actually nationalized the railways. We would acquire an asset which we could then use for tackling climate change, and we could generate income from the sale of railway tickets in the future for the purposes of the public purse and for the purposes of balancing the books, basically. So I think there's a macroeconomic imperative for us to nationalize sectors that are failing right now. A, because we can buy them up very cheaply because they're all going bust. And secondly, because we can use the revenue generated by those assets in the future. And we need to do that in order to, at some point, and at a point which suits the economy, to restore to some sort of stability. But it does mean that the left has to be very clear about this. The left has to be demanding for sound reasons, the nationalization of these assets, and saying, look, take this opportunity to purchase these things cheaply, government, and put them on our books, and then let us make sure that we use them for the purpose of dealing with the next crisis, which is rolling over the hill. There's already talk of fires in Australia and drought in the United States. I mean, we know that temperatures are rising out there, and we've got a blind spot for it at the moment. But the next crisis is going to be an environmental one.
A lot of people are very nervous about activism at the moment. A lot of people are very nervous about campaigning. You know, well, haven't we just got to support the government because, you know, we have no security otherwise, and they're doing their best in a difficult situation and so on. And actually, I think there's many lessons you can draw from the Second World War here, when activism was absolutely vital, both to the protection and security that people had through that war, right? I mean, we had a very laissez-faire government at the time, which really couldn't give a damn about ordinary people or the threat that they were under when London was being bombed and so on. And it was only left-wing activists who got people into the tube stations. The government wouldn't open them, and it wouldn't open them partly because it said, well, people will never come above ground again and never want to go back to work and go back to their houses. So, I mean, we fought for protection for people during the Second World War. And then after the Second World War, it was only as a result of movements and activists that we didn't go to austerity, that we didn't say we've got this massive debt and now we need to write that down, and instead say, well, look, you could do it in the war, you can do it in peacetime, and we can build a decent society where, you know, whether you live or die from diseases isn't in the hands of the private sector. It doesn't depend on how much money you've got in your pocket. It needs to be taken out of the market. And so for all of these reasons, I think it's about campaigning and activism. Whether people decide they're going to get on planes again, whether people decide they're going to go back to high consumption lifestyles and so on, you know, it's something we've got to argue for. And I think when it comes to the environment, there's something we've got to remember here as well, which is that it's not just about what people individually decide they're going to do. You know, I mean, sure, your lifestyle makes some difference. No point saying, you know, I can go out and burn oil drums in the street and it makes no, you know, that's a responsible thing to do. But there are very structural reasons why people live in the way that they do. There are structural reasons why people have become addicted to a mass consumption lifestyle where we get a different mobile phone and computer every 6 months and, you know, are using up the Earth's resources at the rate of knots. So those structural changes have to be made as well. It's not just about making the way we live more sustainable, but actually forcing an economy which embeds some of the logic of degrowth and so on. Not in every country. I mean, some countries, they do need to grow to some degree in order to develop a decent standard of livelihood for the people who live there. But in our kind of economies, yeah, we need a completely different economic model. And what that means is precisely moving away from the kind of high debt, high finance. I mean, we have an economy where economic planning has basically been handed over to the financial sector. Right? And the financial sector incentivizes that planning to be based upon really short-term profitability and shifting as much of the cost as you possibly can onto future generations, onto the environment, onto the public sector, onto the government purse. And unless we change that fundamental logic within our economy, I don't see that the changes that we're talking about here are going to be inevitable. However, what the crisis does do, I think, is give us the opportunity to say, it's really bloody clear, if it wasn't clear before, that we do not have a global economy which protects us, which keeps us safe, which is interested in our welfare, our health, our education, all the rest of it. And it gives us that opportunity that we didn't have, the push, the emergency that can drive our actions towards something new. And, you know, as I said on last time I was on, I think that that was something that happened after the Second World War. And the only thing I hope is we can use this as a wake-up call without saying, you know, things have got to get so much worse, you know, without having to go through something on the scale of the Second World War to get to a place where we can begin building that kind of better society.
I don't know if you saw the 170 Dutch academics who were making a case for a radical change of economic principle. You know, basically take the opportunity that this sudden abrupt halt gives us to rethink how we measure and how we prioritize the economy. And four of their principles were get rid of GDP as a thing to measure, redistribution, change agriculture and land use, reduce consumption and cancel debt. Well, I know, for example, Anne, you would agree with some of that. What would you keep? What would you discard? What would you add? How do we get ourselves into a situation where we're making demands transnationally so that we do have that set of demands as we come out of this?
Degrowth has gone from something that's raised by the global justice movement to potentially being something that's just economies are experiencing. That as this global depression, recession is taking place. So it really becomes a question of managing degrowth potentially or managing less growth in our society.
I have a problem with the whole concept of growth because it is a neoliberal concept. It was invented by the OECD in the 1960s when it set an ambition for the British economy to grow by 50% over 10 years, which was totally unsustainable given that at that point there was full employment here. And they did that because they wanted to see the real economy grow in the same way as the financial economy grows. The financial economy grows by speculation. And if you can think of the lottery, you can put 10 bucks down on the lottery and win £1 million overnight, exponential sums of money, just by gambling, essentially. Of course, you could lose that as well. But capital gains, which is what financiers make through speculation, have this exponential quality to them, whereas the way in which an economy expands cannot be exponential because the economy faces limits. It faces the finite nature of resources and so on and so forth. But the neoliberals in the 1960s said, no, 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 no. In order to compete with the finance sector, the real economy has to grow as fast, if not faster, basically. And that's crazy. So I think we shouldn't even use the term or even use the negation of the term, which is a way of reinforcing the concept. Because what it's really about, what economists are really talking about is, in fact, employment and economic activity. So in my view, we're always going to have economic activity. The idea that we're all going to retire and do nothing is humanly not possible. Humanity just doesn't know how to lie on their backs and be absolutely passive in the face of, you know, the need to survive, the need to feed families and so on and so forth. So we're always going to have economic activity. But for me, what is absolutely fundamental to the economy is the need for employment. And for me, a green economy is going to have to substitute employment for fossil fuels. As I always say, we're going to have to grow our own green beans. We're not going to be able to fly them over from Kenya, drain Kenya of its water table in order to grow the beans and then fly them over here so we can have them 365 days a year. No, we're going to have to engage in growing, being far more self-sufficient. And that's going to be a labor-intensive process. And the reason why employment is so important to the monetary system is that employment generates income. And income is important for everything, basically, but it's also important for the public finances because when people are employed, they pay taxes, and that helps to balance the books. And without employment, people don't have income. And right now we see the impact of people not having impact. If you look at what's happening in America, it's unbelievably brutal. 22 million people have lost their incomes and simultaneously lost access to healthcare. I mean, if that isn't a recipe for revolution in the United States, I really don't know what is. And everyone's expecting that to rise even further. And this is an argument I have with green economists who believe that unemployment is a jolly good thing and we should have unemployment. We should have a high unemployment economy because that way we won't be using the Earth's finite resources. I disagree. I think we need employment, but we will need the kind of employment that doesn't consume Earth's resources. And that means services. You know, we're going to have to do far more education, far more healthcare, far more creativity, far more arts and music, and all of those sorts of activities, which are economic activities and which keep us busy, but which don't necessarily harm the environment for the sake of our own mental health, but also for the sake of the health of the economy. Now, that isn't growth. Full employment isn't growth. Growth is something else. Growth is that you have to go beyond the capacity of the economy. You have to expand exponentially. And if you can't have full employment here, you've got to go out into the world and attract employment from abroad, or you've got to get resources from elsewhere in order to expand even further. That is not sustainable. We're going to have to learn to be far more self-sufficient, in my view. And we should be arguing for a labor-intensive economy that isn't dependent on fossil fuels. It's far more dependent on human energy. We're going to have to move ourselves around. You know, we're going to have to use cycles and other forms of transport that don't consume fossil fuels. And we're going to have to grow our own food and probably even, and I say this with some trepidation, sew our own clothes. You know, we're going to have to learn to do that rather than and be so globally interconnected.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. Coronavirus Lockdown is a new series of podcasts from the Another Europe team with support from Global Justice Now. If you want to know how the discussion ends, you can access additional material by joining the Another Europe is Possible campaign. Members of Another Europe help keep the show on the road even in these difficult times. To join, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we ask our guests to continue this discussion about deglobalisation, industry coming home to the global north, and discuss in this process how we can avoid the dangers of rising nationalism, like we've seen, of course, with Donald Trump. Next week, in a similar vein, we're talking about Narendra Modi and the authoritarian threat he represents to the people of India in this terrible COVID-19 crisis. Looking forward to see you then. Have a good week, and of course, look after each other. Picking up on what you were just saying about globalization and deglobalization and essentially industries coming back to the global north, there's been lots of discussion of this in recent years, including from our friends the Brexiteers, and where they have, I think, a point that maybe people like me or other Remainers, you know, haven't always picked up on, because we said, oh no, look at how the Brexiteers will wreck our trade deals and this will have terrible economic effects. There's a danger in us saying that because we're looking backwards a bit. And if you look at what some of the Brexiteers are saying, and I'm certainly not endorsing any of their nonsense, obviously, but nonetheless, there's a germ of truth in it, which is basically the new wave of automation, which is coming. It will change how production networks are working because we'll have loads of automation in the UK, the Internet of Things, as it's sometimes called, and we won't be as dependent on those global production networks and global transport infrastructures. Now, that's also something that the left and people like Nick have been saying for a long, long time, so they kind of pinched the argument a bit. But we seem to need to prepare for this. But on the other hand, there's a danger that this deglobalization can take a very nationalistic form, because we're kind of living through it already.
Actually, Luke, you've really hit on a fine point here. I find myself kind of trying to negotiate a route between left nationalism, as expressed by, for example, Blue Labour, but also Brexiteers. And I was rather horrified to see Morris Glassman in the New Statesman the other day talk about the death knell of liberal globalization, with which I agree. The invisible hand of the market, he wrote, is being replaced by the mighty fist of the state. And national security is rightly no longer considered an exclusively military matter. That chilled me to the bone, basically, the mighty fist of the state. So we have on the left a form of nationalism, which is scary. And of course, we have on the right some ghastly nationalism as expressed by Trump, but also by, I mean, it's really double-sided, this, because both Trump and Johnson, who profess to be nationalists, who profess to wanting to onshore economic activity, who profess to wanting to protect their people from Mexico or from China or whatever the threat is, or from Europe, at the same time, simultaneously are globalists, are in favor of globalization. And Johnson's February speech at Greenwich is just crazy in terms of it saying, you know, there's this threat of this virus coming, and that's going to want to make people more protectionist and more careful, and we've got to fight against that. And there's nobody else that'll do it, so we have to don the Superman cloak and go out there and defend liberalized globalization. It's a really terrifying speech, and it explains why he deferred tackling this pandemic, because he was frightened that it would exactly do what it has done, which is people would start demanding more protection, if you like, from the connectivity, the negative externalities, if you like, of global connectivity and integration. So we have the nationalists, both left and right wing nationalists on the one side, and then on the other side, we have people like Henry Paulson, who was the US Treasury Secretary of the United States in 2007-09 and who bankrupted Lehman's, calling in the Financial Times last Saturday for a defense against the anti-globalization movements. And I find myself weaving my way between these two, because I'm anti-globalization, but I'm also not a nationalist. And I grew up, by the way, in South Africa under a nationalist government, so I know about nationalism. It's terrifying, it's awful, it's racist, and so on. And the question is, how do we maintain our commitment to internationalism while admitting that actually we also have to be more self-sufficient? And that is a very tricky road to walk, I think. But we have to do it in a very principled way. And we have to take sucker from the fact that between 1945 and 1971, this is exactly how the global economy was organized. Central banks had a mandate to look after the interests of the domestic economy. Their mandate was not to look after the interests of the globalized economy, of international capital markets, of Wall Street and the City of London. They had to look after the interests of their people. You know, governments felt that was their mandate. So domestic economies were given autonomy and the ability to nurture their people and protect their people, and in particular the economic security of their people. At the same time, there was international coordination. We established the United Nations, we set up the World Health Organization, we engaged in these multilateral institutions and financed them and supported them. Plus, something called the G8 was set up, and the G8 was a place where there was international coordination take place between world leaders. Those systems are disintegrating. Trump is trying to destroy the World Health Organization. He's trying to destroy the IMF. He's certainly undermined the G8 and the G20, doesn't want to have these meetings. These meetings are now a laughing stock. So there's no international coordination. We're ending multilateral collaboration and solidarity, and it's every man for himself. And this is breeding nationalism and authoritarianism, and I'm afraid fascism. So this is a really difficult path to walk for the left, but walk it we must. And with, you know, conviction that our internationalism is fundamental to our politics, but also an understanding that there is no such thing as a globalized government. We can't be governed by markets. We can't be governed by financial markets. Democracy demands that we should have our own systems and that governments should protect the interests of their own people. And that's not easy to argue, but I do hope that the left will argue this more vehemently than it's done, because what's happening now is it's the Glassmans of this world talking about the mighty fist of the state. And then it's, you know, Boris Johnson and some of the crazy people inside the Tory party. And then, of course, there's the crazies inside the Republican Party in the United States. And then there's, you know, Modi in India, there's both Turkey and Hungary, but also China, of course, where there is greater authoritarianism. So, you know, the left's voice here is very, very quiet, is very, very subdued. And we have to raise it.
Nick, you've been working on global justice for a very long time. You presumably don't see the necessary opposite side of that pendulum as being hyper-nationalism.
No, we never have. And part of the problem here is, there's more than one form of international cooperation. There's more than one form of internationalism. And in the 50s, 60s and 70s, and my organization was founded in 1970, a great time of hope for internationalism and international cooperation. There were countries that were just becoming free of the chains of empire who were arguing for a radically different form of international economy. I mean, they went to the UN in 1975 and they won in the General Assembly the new International Economic Order, a wonderful document that today looks like, you know, an NGO's produced it. This was UN policy for a radical redistribution of wealth and power at an international level, for a control of finance, a control of multinational corporations, and all the rest of it. And it brings us back to our starting point, because the third world debt crisis was what was used by rich governments and the financiers to undermine and marginalize that whole project. And so, you know, you had really exciting possibilities when the World Health Organization was not just set up, but was taking on the tobacco giants, was calling for healthcare as a right for every single person in the world at the end of the 1970s. Reagan and Thatcher came in and they said, we don't want any of that. We'll stop funding these organizations. We'll stop funding UNCTAD. We'll marginalize those parts of the system. And we will create a form of international cooperation, a form of globalization, which puts the markets in charge and puts money in charge and gets rid of all these pesky governments in the global south. And the problem is, this was a historic defeat. It's why I still believe third world debt crisis should be taught in primary schools almost. It's so important to understanding politics and how it's evolved in the last 40 years. And very few people actually know about it. But this crisis was used in a way that inflicted a historic defeat on the left and our vision of what internationalism could have been. And by the time you get to the 90s, you get Clinton and Blair basically saying, well, globalization is what we've got. Let's try and make it a little bit nicer. Right. So completely giving up on an alternative form of internationalism, which is why people like me were not, you know, I wasn't embarrassed to say I was part of the anti-globalization movement, because for me, globalization, as we understand it today, is an economic project, which is about corporate power and financial power and so on. And I am against that. I'm fundamentally against that. I don't think the only alternative to that is Trump style nationalism. It absolutely can't be. And we've seen glimpses, and we still see glimpses in the World Health Organization, you know, the good bits of it that are left in international human rights law, in international humanitarian law, in some regional integrations. I mean, partly, although by no means completely, in the European Union, but partly in some of the international, in the economic integration you've seen in Latin America, you see really different forms of international cooperation and international governance. And that's something we've got to fight for. Now, it is difficult, and it's difficult. And I think the reason that, Anne, you feel in a dilemma about this, and so do I sometimes, is because we just haven't put forward a strong enough vision, because we've been so defeated for such a long time, of what we mean by that internationalism. And that's our task at the moment. And it's the reason why I'm kind of neither pessimistic nor optimistic. I don't know how things are going to turn out, but how they turn out will absolutely depend upon us being able to put forward that vision and convince enough people of its legitimacy in the coming years. And if we don't, we are absolutely handing. And I mean, even today, I mean, like Annie, of course, what Trump's doing is absolutely horrific. But at the same time, the self-proclaimed globalists are not helping by saying this is the only form of economy that you could possibly have. They're driving people into Trump's hands because people are saying, we don't want that. We've seen the utterly unequal and antisocial outcomes of your form of globalization, and we want something different. And if this idiot's going to say he's got something different on offer, well, maybe we'll give him a go. You know, and you're seeing that all around the world at the moment. So the left has to take on its own share of blame, I feel, for this. And it's time for us to really say, this is an alternative. This is an alternative which grants protection, which grants employment and security and all the other things that make up a good life to people and looks after our environment and so on and believes in international cooperation, all the rest of it. We've got to make that into a compelling vision that we can mobilize people in our society around. And if we don't do that, then, you know, then we really are in very, very serious trouble. Will we be able to? I don't know. That's the project. That's our task. That's our challenge.
Nick, could I just ask, how far do you think or feel the pendulum has swung away from neoliberalism in the global south in the sense of governments in the global south and their political coloration? Because, you know, I feel that the cases that we talk about are the strongman nationalist cases, Modi, Bolsonaro, etc. But is there a groundswell of opinion in the cases that we don't hear about away from IMF structural adjustment style political economic solutions? And then within the international institutions, a lot of attention comes like every few years that the IMF and World Bank will publish a report saying, well, austerity was a terrible idea, we've decided 10 years afterwards, and it didn't have very good economic effects. So there does seem to be some changes within the official institutions of globalization that suggest that things might be changing a bit. I don't know if you agree.
It's difficult. I mean, you don't see an awful lot of hope coming out of southern governments today in the way that you did in the 1970s, and frankly, in the way you did in the 1990s in Latin America. I mean, the collapse of the Pink Tide governments has left a gaping hole. I mean, they were the biggest challenge we had to the neoliberal system. And their collapse has left a gaping hole on the left in terms of governance. So what you see now is a mixture of neoliberal governments, or governments who basically do what they're told, because this is where the development funding comes from. This is what the IMF tells you to do. And especially in Africa, that's very common. And then you see a rising now of the nationalistic populist governments, from Modi to Duterte to Bolsonaro and so on. I mean, there was a moment of hope there when you had the kind of emerging markets, and there is still some hope, I think, in terms of the economics of that. I mean, I don't know if Anne would agree with me, but I certainly think in terms of China, this is very interesting. I mean, I am no supporter of the Chinese political regime. However, they have developed absolutely by ripping up the financialized neoliberal rulebook. I mean, they have not developed in that way. They have proved that the way to develop is not that. And that's interesting. Will other countries learn from that? Will other countries have the space to carry out some of those lessons that we already knew, really? Who knows? But you don't really get at the moment, I don't think, a very strong voice calling for a kind of left-wing economic and internationalist political solution. I can't think of many governments at the moment who are pushing that line.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think it is quite depressing. We don't have sort of, if you like, on the one hand, intellectual leadership, or sufficient intellectual leadership. I was so sad when I heard of Martin Kaur dying in Malaysia. He was such a giant, intellectual giant for the South. There is some intellectual leadership at UNCTAD, but that institution, like all the institutions, has been slowly undermined. But on the whole, we don't see it by governments who cling on to power precisely because they are wedded to the financial markets. So something has to happen. And I feel this is a moment when something could happen, because things have just gone too far and the injustice of the current international arrangements have just become so severe that there must be a reaction. And let's see what will it be.